Hello, I'm Barbara Brady, the Vice President and Director of Neutral Management at FINRA Dispute Resolution. Welcome and thank you for listening to this neutral workshop. I'm pleased to introduce our two other FINRA speakers, Linda Feinberg and George Friedman. Linda is the president of the forum, and George is its executive vice president and director of arbitration. Together with me, they will take you through the key changes in FINRA dispute resolution in 2011, recall items of interest, and address changes in the pipeline for 2012. We have a very ambitious agenda for this workshop, so let's get started. To begin, Linda, do you want to start with some statistics and then address the customer option rule?
Thanks, Barbara. It's difficult to assimilate a lot of numbers during an audio workshop, so I will keep the details to a minimum. As you all know, the caseload is down compared to previous years. As many of you have heard us say before, our caseload is counter-cyclical to the market. People complain less when they are making money, and of course they complain more when they are losing money. If one juxtaposes a graph of the S&P 500 with a graph of our case filings, you will see they move in directly opposite directions. From 2007 to 2008, customer claims nearly doubled, and from 2008 to 2009, they increased by 43%. However, case filings decreased in 2010 compared to 2009 and continue to decrease. In 2010, parties filed 5,680 claims, a decrease of 20% compared to 2009. And in 2011, they filed 4,729 cases, a decrease of 17% compared to 2010. If you wish to review the statistics in greater detail, you can do so by looking at our website through the link available below the link to this workshop. Now turning to the customer option rule. As we've discussed before, in 2011, the SEC approved a major rule change allowing all investors filing arbitration claims the option of having an all-public panel. This new rule greatly increases investor choice in the FINRA arbitration program. The rule became effective on February 1, 2011, and applies to all customer cases in which no arbitrator selection list had been sent as of that date. To briefly recap, the rule gives investors the choice of either the majority public panel option, which provides for a panel of one chair qualified public arbitrator, one public arbitrator, and one non-public arbitrator, or the all-public panel option, which allows parties to select an all-public arbitration panel, but also provides the opportunity to have a majority public panel. Between February 1, 2011 and December 31, 2011, investors filed 2,514 cases eligible for choosing the all-public panel option. As of December 31, investors in 76% of eligible cases have chosen the all-public panel option. This opt-in rate is significantly higher than the 54% rate we saw during the pilot program that preceded this rule. The new rule does not apply to arbitration disputes involving only industry parties. And since intra-industry cases constitute anywhere from 30 to 35% of the claims filed at FINRA, we continue to need a robust roster of non-public arbitrators. It is too early to analyze results, as too few awards have been issued under the new rule. I can tell you that under the pilot program, where we have had a significant number of awards, there is essentially no difference between all public and majority public panels. By that I mean, in cases that chose to participate in the pilot program, both types of panels awarded damages to customers a bit over 60% of the time. This compares to about 50% in non-pilot cases during the same period. We are tracking award results of customer claims processed under the All Public Panel Rule and the Majority Public Panel Rule, and will publish the comparative data when more awards become available. For those who wish to see the awards, they are available on our website through the Arbitration Awards online link at our homepage at www.finra.org. I'll now turn the microphone over to George, who will discuss the rule change to expand the arbitration selection list.
Thanks, Linda. In response to continued concern about extended lists, FINRA proposed and the SEC approved an amendment to Customer Code Rule 12403 that expands the number of arbitrators on each list, that is public, non-public, and share qualified, from 8 arbitrators to 10. I should probably step back and define the term extended list. Very briefly, what this means, when we send out lists of proposed arbitrators, if for whatever reason we cannot complete the panel from the lists that are executed and returned by the parties, we go to the computer and say, give us a name randomly to fill that seat. That's called an extended list arbitrator. And it's been a great unifying factor in the forum because parties from all sides tend not to like that. So it used to be that we sent out lists of 8 names, 8 public, 8 non-public, and 8 share qualified, and the parties had limited strikes. We expanded through this rule change from 8 names to 10. The additional names have increased, we think, the likelihood that the parties get panelists that they choose and ranked, rather than when FINRA must do this through the computer system. This also becomes a factor when we need to replace an arbitrator as well, as I'll discuss later. The rule change went into effect on September 27, 2010, and applies to all lists generated on or after that date. Now, we've provided links to the Federal Register and regulatory notice that you can find with the link that you clicked on to get this audio recording. Now, already the rule has worked. It's been about a year and a half. Before it went into effect, we had to use the computer to complete the panel about 18% of the time. Since the rule went into effect, that's dropped to only 3% of the time. So, again, it used to be 18% of the time we needed to go to the computer to complete one or more slots on the panel. That's dropped to 3. But we want to reduce extended list appointments to 0 because we know the parties don't like this. Parties especially dislike what I call out-of-the-blue replacements, and typically that happens when the hearing is set. Parties are all set to go ahead with the panel, and for whatever reason, an arbitrator has to depart the panel. Now, what we do then is we go back to the list that the parties have executed, and we see if there are names left to fill that seat. But if not, we go ahead and extend the list. And when that happens pretty much out of the blue at the last minute, parties don't like that. So we're trying to address that. We recently announced on our webpage a new pilot that describes the party's ability by agreement, to eliminate extended list appointments in cases where hearing dates have been set. That was a mouthful. So again, I'll describe the core elements of the pilot, and by the way, this applies to both customer and industry cases as well. So briefly, here's how it works. As I mentioned, parties have to agree in writing. In that writing, they can stipulate to strike and rank an additional short list of potential arbitrators to find a replacement when we've gone back to the list and, in fact, find no ranked arbitrators remain from the party's initial list. So again, rather than going to the computer and saying, who do we have in this hearing location to fill the vacancy, we're going to send the parties a short list of 3 names. What can they do with that name, with that list? They can strike one arbitrator's name from the list. That is, each party can strike one of the 3 names and rank the remaining names in order of preference within a certain number of days. In preparing the list, what we're going to do is pre-screen the names of potential arbitrators to make sure they're available for the potential hearing dates. So that's a key feature. So the staff will first make sure the potential arbitrators can make the date, and then send the parties this short list of 3. Again, parties have to mutually agree to this process, and if they don't agree, of course, we'll go back to what the Code of Arbitration procedure provides, which is we will replace the arbitrator either through the names the parties have left on their list or, in fact, when that doesn't happen, through an extended list. You should note where it's hearing scheduled within 5 calendar days of the arbitrator's withdrawal or unavailability, that is the triggering event for replacing the arbitrator, the parties will need to stipulate to a postponement so we have time to use a shortlist process and to pre-screen arbitrators. And I hate to bring this part up, but there is the unpleasant matter of fees. If the parties do postpone a case in that instance, they'll have to pay postponement fees as provided in the code. After a decent period for evaluation, we're going to consider whether this works and, in fact, think about a formal rule that could codify and extend the procedures. Now, on to a second topic, the discovery guide. As you know, we made several changes to the discovery guide last May. It took us a long time to get there, and let me just briefly summarize this because we did spend quite a bit of time talking about this on prior calls. This was the first update to the discovery guide since 1999. Now, the discovery guide has lists of presumptively discoverable cases and materials in customer cases. It took us a long time to get to the change. The prior version of the guide had 14 lists of presumptively discoverable documents. That is 2 general lists, one for the customer and one for the industry party or parties, and then 12 separate lists depending on the type of claims, for example, churning, what have you. Presumptively discoverable, that's a lot of lists. The major change coming out of the discovery guide that went into effect last May, we now have 2 lists of presumptively discoverable documents. Again, one for the firm or associated persons and one for customers. Now, many of the documents in the prior list have been incorporated into these 2 lists. But we've streamlined things greatly, and we've also added some documents that the parties told us were necessary to be included. Now, I underscore the term presumptively discoverable. The guide's introduction and, in fact, the arbitrator training that we've created to reinforce the message about the new discovery guide points out that the guide needs to be tailored based on the facts and circumstances of the case. Stated differently, you know, just because something's on the list doesn't mean it has to be produced. It's just presumptively discoverable. And conversely, if something's not on the list, it doesn't mean it doesn't have to be produced. So the instructions to the arbitrators are, you know, consider the facts and circumstances of the case. But to begin with, these are presumptively discoverable. Now, we changed several things. I'll summarize a few of them. In the introduction, we talk about things like flexibility, objections based on cost and burden and how to deal with that, requests for additional documents, party and non-party production, consideration of firm business models, this was a change, a new thing, and customer claims. I'll come back to this, the new guides briefly touch upon electronic discovery, easy for me to say, by saying, you know, documents can be things that are produced electronically. More about that later. Other things covered, confidentiality and privilege, affirmations, importantly, no obligation to create documents for discovery purposes. So, for example, if there's a request for a net worth statement, and in fact, the customer doesn't have one, they don't have to go about and create one for the purposes of discoverability. And finally, admissibility. It's a long list. And, of course, we have a separate training program available for arbitrators online if you want to get a refresher. Now, one of the many important things that came out of our efforts to create the discovery guide and to update it was the establishment of a task force. We committed in our rule filing to create a task force to keep the discovery guide fresh. One major reason is that, you know, again, I mentioned the original discovery guide was created in 1999. You know, we don't want to wait 12 years to do the next one. So the purpose of the task force is to keep it fresh and current. And right now it's working on emerging issues surrounding e-discovery and also product cases. We formed the task force under the auspices of FINRA's National Arbitration and Mediation Committee. It consists of public and industry participants as well as arbitrators. And again, they're focusing now on e-discovery and product issues. And we hope and suspect that the task force will help us keep the guide current and up to date. Linda, we have some exciting news that will, I think, enhance the lives of neutrals regarding our technology initiatives. Can you share some information on that?
Yes, I'm delighted to let you know where we're moving ahead in our technology development. This January, we began work on a new technology project to enhance service for dispute resolution neutrals and parties by creating a self-service web portal. What does this mean for you? FINRA arbitrators and mediators will be able to perform many functions online, including updating personal profiles and disclosures, viewing the status of a case and case documents, scheduling hearing dates, and submitting evaluations about staff and fellow arbitrators. We also will develop a more robust online application for prospective new arbitrators. There also will be important advances for parties. In addition to our current online claim filing function, parties will be able to sign into a secure website and perform many functions online, including receiving service of a claim and answering a claim, submitting additional case documents, viewing the status of a case and case documents, submitting arbitrator rankings for list selection, scheduling hearing dates, and paying fees. This project will be implemented as a series of releases over the course of the next 2 to 3 years, with the first enhancements for our arbitrators and mediators, followed by improvement for parties.
Thanks, Linda. That's very exciting, and we really can't wait to see the changes to Matrix. Let me now discuss a change to the Code of Arbitration Procedure concerning promissory note cases. Last April, the SEC approved a rule change to the industry code that provides that FINRA will appoint a chair-qualified public arbitrator to a panel involving a promissory note dispute instead of limiting the pool of potential arbitrators to those qualified to hear statutory discrimination matters. Under the rule change, the number of arbitrators available for appointment in promissory note cases will increase significantly. That might raise a question as to why we did that. As Linda said, industry cases now comprise about a third of our caseload. It's been a fairly dramatic increase in those. Many of those involve promissory note cases. So we think the rule change will ensure that FINRA has a sufficient number of qualified arbitrators available to resolve this growing part of our caseload without diminishing the quality of the service that's rendered in those cases. The rule change amends the industry code rule 13806, and it went into effect on June 6th last year. Barbara, could you update the neutrals on disclosure obligations and then perhaps discuss arbitrator training, starting with, I think, what's moving us to focus arbitrators on disclosure?
Yeah, I would love to do that. Thank you, George. FINRA recently updated the arbitrator disclosure checklist that all of our arbitrators must complete at the outset of cases on which they're serving. Please make sure that you read the checklist carefully, as the form has changed substantially. And I will reiterate that. Please, please read it carefully. It's changed quite a bit. The revised checklist is intended to ensure that arbitrators consider all possible disclosures and provide a complete explanation of any disclosed conflict to the parties. Briefly, the new checklist uses more straightforward and consistent language throughout the document. It groups the questions by topic and provides a roadmap. And it adds new questions to seek information about name changes, non-securities accounts, opinions formed about the case, ongoing relationships with former firms, current litigation or arbitration, unsatisfied judgments or liens or foreclosures, or any additional disclosure not captured by the questions. And finally, explains in plain English why we are asking these different questions. Similar changes are currently being made to the arbitrator application.
So why the emphasis on disclosure?
Well, one of our biggest arbitrator training goals this year was to reinforce the message that arbitrators must disclose conflicts of interest that could reasonably call into question the arbitrator's integrity and ability to serve impartially. Since October, arbitrators have been able to participate in a new audio workshop on arbitrator disclosure. We substantially enhanced and re-released our online training module on the duty to disclose, and we strongly encourage arbitrators to participate in the revised course which is available now on our website at no charge. Additionally, Volume 4 of 2011 of The Neutral Corner, the newsletter for our arbitrators, features a 3.5-page article that offers practical guidance to arbitrators to fulfill their obligation to disclose. Topics discussed include the rules that set forth an arbitrator's duty to disclose, including the ongoing nature of that duty, the arbitrator disclosure checklist that arbitrators receive when they are appointed to a case, using conflict software or creating a conflicts folder, disclosure of social and professional relationships, including relationships formed or maintained on social media sites, and disclosure at the first pre-hearing conference. One of the primary benefits of arbitration, a final and binding award, is jeopardized when awards are vacated because of an arbitrator's failure to make disclosures. Arbitrators who fail to disclose required information may be subject to permanent removal from the roster. A final note about arbitrator training. We have already made training free in our effort to encourage more arbitrators to participate in training. Arbitrators who wish to complete an arbitrator training course and receive credit for it by including it on their arbitrator disclosure report need to log into the learning management system to complete the course. Registering in the learning management system allows FINRA to track an arbitrator's completion of a course. Access to the learning management system can be found on the basic arbitrator training and advanced arbitrator training pages of our website. However, to help arbitrators refresh their understanding of a course they previously completed and passed, and which they previously received credit for, we have also made available on the forum's website all of our training materials. Arbitrators should only access the courses through our website in this manner and not go through the learning management system if they do not expect credit for the course. Let me reiterate, arbitrators who have not successfully completed a training course and wish to get credit for a course should access the materials through the learning management system. And George, what else do our neutrals need to know? I believe there's something going on with regard to expungement in re procedures.
Yes, there is. In December, FINRA's board authorized staff to issue a regulatory notice requesting comment on a rule proposal that will amend the codes of arbitration procedure for both customer and industry disputes to adopt new rules. What would these new rules do? They would permit persons who are the, quote, subject of allegations of sales practice violations made in arbitration claims, but who are not named as parties to arbitration, to seek expungement relief by initiating in re expungement proceedings. It's a lot of stuff. Let me break it out. There was a rule change in May 2009 that requires changes to the individual broker's record if he or she is described in an arbitration but not named. So, for example, if the arbitration does not name the broker as the party, but in fact says broker Smith committed the following acts, that broker Smith needs to have his CRD record updated. Similarly, if the behavior described makes it pretty obvious who the broker was, for example, my account was churned during this particular time period and there was only one broker involved in the case, again, the firms have to make an effort to look to identify the broker and change the CRD. So what this rule would do is create a possibility of relief for those individuals who are not, in fact, named in the arbitration. The proposed in re proceeding would eliminate the practice of naming public customers, or brokerage firms, for that matter, as respondents in claims seeking expungement. However, unnamed persons would still retain the ability to have their firm or former firm seek expungement in the underlying customer arbitration. In other words, today, if such an arbitration is commenced, and again, the individual is not named, the firm can and sometimes does seek expungement on behalf of the unnamed broker, and they can continue to do that. But this new rule would set up the ability for a broker to seek an in re proceeding to get expungement in the event that didn't happen. The proposal also clarifies that if an associated person is named as a respondent in the customer-initiated arbitration case, that person can seek expungement of customer dispute information only, as I described above, in that customer case. So if you're named, you have to proceed and get your expungement in the case, in the underlying customer case. This is for those whose CRD records are impacted, were not named, and otherwise cannot seek for expungement relief. Now, typically when we propose a rule to the board, they authorize staff to go ahead and do a rule filing with the SEC. Because this is a fairly major rule filing and fairly complex, we're going to take the step of doing a regulatory notice first. So I would look for that fairly soon. We're going to seek comments from the public, from all involved, on the rule, and there should be details, as I said, fairly soon. Barbara, back to you to wrap it up.
Well, thank you, Linda and George, for bringing FINRA's neutral roster up to date on the forum's activities. Before we conclude, I just want to mention, for those arbitrators who did not see our email blast, that effective January 1, 2012, FINRA increased the meal allowance for arbitrators from $20 to $25 for most reimbursement categories. A link to the updated guidelines for arbitrator reimbursement, as well as links to all the reference materials that we mentioned during this workshop, are available with the link to this audio file. FINRA Dispute Resolution strives to be the preeminent provider of securities-related dispute resolution services. This goal was only possible when talented, dedicated arbitrators and mediators aid in the process. So I want to take this opportunity to thank you for your support and cooperation. We value your time, and we value your commitment. If you have any additional questions about this workshop, please send them to FINRA DR call-in workshop. There is a link to this mailbox with the link for this audio recording. Thank you for listening.